And we are rolling. Hi, Gina.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good. So this is Mark Goldberg with UN Dispatch speaking with.
Gina Moore of BuzzFeed.
And you are currently in Nairobi, correct?
I am.
Great. So, we have a lot to discuss in the short period of time in which we will be discussing the Rwanda genocide, the Central African Republic, other issues you're working on. But sort of we are speaking on a Thursday, and on Monday, the international community commemorated the 20th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide. And you published a real fascinating interview with Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda. So just first quick question, were you in Rwanda this past Monday for the commemoration?
I was.
So what was that like? What was your experience?
It was interesting. I've been going to commemorative events since 2008, not every year, but most years. And there was a lot of commonalities between what I have seen happen in the past and what happened on Monday. And of course, the size and scale of Monday was much larger in terms of international community presence. There was several heads of state. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, was there, along with a delegation of other folks from the U.S. government, including the Stephen Rapp, who's a special ambassador for
War
war
crimes
crimes
issues.
issues,
Yeah.
and some other folks. So it was a very, there was quite a VIP contingent. There was a security heightening element that went with that, but there was also an interesting investment in artistic expression around the genocide, the legacy of the genocide, the meaning of the memory. There was a play that was put on that was quite dramatic, and the survivors who I talked to about that particular performance, the theatrical performance that happened there in the stadium, in Amahoro Stadium, where the event was, really touched people. And so that was interesting to see. And I saw again, as I've seen before, some survivors who were present for the programming. It's called in Rwandan English, when the Rwandans explain this to me, they say they have gotten trauma or they get trauma. And it is a moment that happened fairly frequently on Monday as the official program was going on in the stadium, where survivors would break down and cry, and it's a wail that you can hear around the stadium. And there are some psychosocial support services available for them, and so usually they're accompanied out of the stadium to take advantage of those support services and just to sort of have a moment to themselves away from the storytelling and the programming that's maybe put them back in that place. And so that was going on too. It's certainly the livingness of the memory was definitely present.
So that's such an interesting sort of linguistic formulation to get trauma. Is it, I mean, do you think it's like you said, it's because it's sort of, the genocide, the trauma was, fairly recent as far as these things go?
I'm sure that has quite a lot to do with it, and there's a lot about April in the conversations that I've had over the years with survivors that seems to bring viscerally a lot of memories back. The same way I would imagine that, you or I or any sort of ordinary Americans will smell a certain smell and you're immediately back in your childhood. Visceral senses can bring us so much more quickly to memories and back to places where we were, than, our own intellectual capacities, in some cases. And I think that that's also part of it. April is a rainy month in Rwanda. It's the height of rainy season, in the long rains. For some people, being hungry, not having enough to eat, can really elevate the trauma, because it reminds people of the families that they've lost. This is how it's been explained to me. It reminds people of the families that they've lost, that if they still had relatives, there would be someone there to help them to make sure they weren't hungry. And because it was only recently pointed out to me, I was a little embarrassed. I'd never thought of this. It can remind people of what it was like to survive the genocide without food, water, help, assistance. So there are those elements at play too.
So you're talking a bit about sort of the official delegation. I think it was interesting that one country that was absent from the official delegation was France. I think so they had sort of planned to attend, but then sort of and you probably know the TikTok of what happened better than I do, but my understanding is sort of shortly before the maybe like on Sunday night or on Saturday, Paul Kagame made some remark about how France was complicit in the genocide, and then France decided to pull out of their sort of delegation, or decided to boycott the commemoration somehow. Was that sort of that was, I think, what got most attention in the international media around the commemoration? Did that receive a lot of attention inside Rwanda?
Yeah, a fair amount. Although I would say that probably a lot of people in Rwanda are, in maybe a way that sounds a little cynical, but not entirely surprised. The relations between France and Rwanda are often rocky. I think it was viewed as a bit of an overreaction by the French to pull out of so important a moment at the last minute. Over an interview, a comment in an interview, in which, I mean, it depends on how you read these things, but there's not all that much that the president said in the interview that offended France that he hadn't really said before. And so the response was a little surprised, and you know, it's insulting. It came across in Rwanda as an insult at a very sensitive time of year, I would say. I didn't speak to any officials about this or anything, just sort of the mood of the reaction among people that I talked to. And then, of course, Rwanda disinvited the French ambassador to the ceremony, which I think by some was viewed as maybe the right reaction.
So speaking of the President Paul Kagame, you landed an interview with him, what is it, a couple weeks ago?
It was a week ago Monday. Yeah, it was the end of March.
So set the scene for us. I mean, he's not inaccessible, but, you don't see an interview like that so often. It was just, fantastic to see it in BuzzFeed. So set the scene. So how did you approach Kagame, and what were your impressions of him, and what was your big takeaway from the interview?
Well, there were six of us in the room. It was an organized, the way it was described as a roundtable with the press. Mm-hmm. One representative from media in Uganda, Kenya, Japan, Canada, France, and the United States. And they called us, which we were thrilled to be there for. But it's a little difficult to interview a head of state when you're six people in the room and you've only just met, and you ideally you'd be able to sort of coordinate your questions and that sort of thing. But it all happened very, very suddenly the night before, really. And so we were all, trying to feel out the room. But the president was very open and generous with his time. I would say we ended up spending about 2 hours together, even though the conversation was slotted for 90 minutes. And it was because he wanted to continue to discuss some of the matters that we were talking about. So it was an interesting conversation. I mean, on the whole, I think that close readers will probably see that there's very little that came out of the conversation that hasn't in some way been said before. One thing that did stick out to me as something I hadn't heard quite so directly before was his characterization of some of the criticism by the international community of Rwanda, particularly on political and political rights. And this is obviously a point of tension that's existed for a long time, and a critique that comes up very often, and one that Kagame, I think, is fairly used to having conversations about. But in our conversation, he went so far as to say that the international community seems to prefer pre-genocidal Rwanda, which it took less critical interest in, than the current Rwanda. And of course, we all know that pre-genocide Rwanda was on a path toward genocide, the sort of subtle implication being another layer of complicity, right? And so that really stuck out to me. I was surprised to hear that quite so blatantly, although the criticism of the international community and their complicity in the genocide is, of course, a fairly well-known story.
So, I mean, that's so interesting because, I guess it seems to me, I've only been to Rwanda once and just briefly, but that it's a country that since the genocide, and particularly over the last 10 years, has experienced a pretty sort of remarkable economic growth and is sort of trending in all the right directions and all the right sort of social and economic and development indicators. But that in recent years, it has become more and more sort of a politically repressive place. So you have this sort of phenomenon where you have a country that, sort of works very well with the international community on development issues and on health issues, but has a sort of tense and growingly sort of contentious relationship with the international community on political issues, particularly, I mean, internally as well as sort of its relationship with neighboring DRC. Would you say that's sort of a fair characterization, or is that maybe too simplistic?
The tension between Rwanda and the international community?
Well, just the idea that sort of whereas Rwanda has been trending in the right direction economically, experienced, you know, economic growth that has, that sort of outpaces a lot of its neighbors, that it's sort of at the same time become a more politically repressive place.
I don't know about that. And when I say I don't know about that, I mean that I would want to sit down with a bunch of studies and sort of compare them over time. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I've spent a lot of time there as a journalist, and I lived there for a long stretch in 2008. I started going to Rwanda in 2005. And so I've seen some ups and downs in what's experienced or what gets articulated in the international community as freedom of expression. I think that's a really elastic idea in Rwanda, and some areas are a little bit more open than others for reasons that I think sometimes the international community gets right and sometimes they get wrong in terms of political pressures and the sort of catalyst of an election, for example. And I certainly saw in the lead up to the 2010 presidential election a shift in the media narrative about Rwanda, the Western media's narrative about Rwanda, toward a more questioning stance of Kagame than it had taken before. I mean, before 2010, everyone was happy to come to Rwanda and write stories about the amazing model that it is as, for business. It's so easy to open a business. It's the one functioning African country, the failed state that wasn't a failed state, better at universal health care than the United States, right? There were lots of really interesting sort of narrative memes that we could grab at. And when I say we, I mean the media. And people did. And then when the second election came around, it was clear that there was not really a candidate who was going to hold a candle to Kagame. And we see this in the United States with election stories too, right? As soon as we're looking at a landslide for one candidate, the media starts to tell a little bit of a different story. And so the more interesting media question became, oh, well, but, you know, he may have achieved all these things, but is he also an authoritarian? Is he a dictator? Is he a tyrant? You know, pick your word choice here. And there's a lot to be investigated on that. But when you say that it's recently become more politically repressive, I'm not sure that that's not actually that it's only recently that the international media has decided that that's the story they want to write. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. No, it makes perfect sense. I just remember being at, so it seems that sort of international forums, you know, say pre-2010. You would see him sort of feted. You'd see Kagame feted in a way. You know, I remember I was at like the Clinton Global Initiative and he sat next to Hillary Clinton while Bill Clinton was giving an address. Or, you know, you see him at UN forums, particularly around health and development, sort of being cited as or being sort of cited as an example of, you know, how to do like maternal health right, you know, in a country. Mm-hmm. Yet at the same time, and this I think is more recent, you see sort of other parts of the UN system, like the Security Council, has where Rwanda has a seat, but particularly in sort of UN peacekeeping and DRC, where Rwanda has been accused of supporting rebels in the Democratic Republic of the Congo that are sort of working against sort of, you know, the interests of peace in the region. So it seems that there's like this very that on the one hand the international community celebrates Kagame in Rwanda, on the other hand, they're very concerned, I think, about sort of recent trends.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. And you certainly see consequences in the last couple of years to, it's usually an investigation by the UN group of experts, right? When the UN group of experts.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to.
Right. Yeah. When one of their reports comes out and there's, and you know, they do these heavy investigations and they've been doing them since 2007 and six maybe. In any event, those investigations, those reports by the group of experts have been tied to, you know, aid changes for Rwanda in the last couple of years, which is new. And Rwanda's actually had an interesting response to that. Excuse me, these headphones are falling out.
That's a problem.
In 2012, I want to say, I could be wrong about this, but I think it was 2012, the government put together a campaign called the Agaciro campaign. Agaciro is translated as dignity. And it was a campaign to make donations to the country, essentially to replace some of the aid that went missing. And some of those aid relationships have since been restored, but the campaign is continuing. And that's a language that I've continued to see in Rwanda, something that has outlasted the sort of political moment that it came out of, perhaps. I mean, I suppose you could dispute whether it came out of a political moment, but it certainly seemed tied to the whole aid dilemma, tied to the Group of Experts report. And so that goes on, and you hear a lot. On Monday, there was a lot of discussion. There was a lot of use of the word dignity. There was a lot of use of the idea of self-sufficiency, self-reliance, some praise of Rwanda's ability to rebuild itself in this way, that all that kind of goes together with this idea of Agaciro. And so it's interesting to see that continuing to grow.
That concept's so interesting. I remember, so I was in Rwanda in 2008, and I remember seeing a billboard on the side of the road that sort of linked patriotism to paying your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like a fascinating concept that, you know, if you love your, it's sort of, you know, pay your taxes because you love your country.
Right. Right. And I think that has real resonance in Rwanda, actually. I mean, I think, you know, it's probably more of us in the United States who try to dodge a tax bill than anything. Mm-hmm. But there is a communal spirit about that kind of thing in Rwanda that's really interesting.
I guess sort of, you know, this sort of opportunity, this 20th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide sort of provides an inflection point on, you know, current challenges to preventing ethnic cleansing and maybe genocide elsewhere. And sort of one of the sort of leading the U.S. Delegation to the 20th anniversary commemoration was Samantha Power. And sort of on her way back from there, she stopped in the Central African Republic, making this her second trip to the Central African Republic, and also making her the sort of highest ranking U.S. official to ever set foot in the CAR. Because sort of right there there is sort of an ongoing sort of ethnic cleansing. So we're recording this on Thursday, and sort of about an hour before, you know, we spoke, the UN Security Council just passed a resolution authorizing a peacekeeping force there of about 12,000. Sort of you as sort of, you know, I kind of follow these events from afar. You're in Nairobi. How is, the sort of crisis in the Central African Republic playing out in the region? Is this something that people in Kenya are following? Is this something that you're following closely? I'm just kind of curious to know sort of what its resonance is in sub-Saharan Africa.
It is something I'm following closely. I was in the Central African Republic in 2010 in the course of doing a project about UN peacebuilding, the UN Peacebuilding Commission.
I remember that project, actually. It was really interesting.
Thank you. Yeah. It took me to some really interesting places at some very interesting times. But the UN Peacebuilding Commission idea is, sadly, as we think about the Central African Republic now, as the Central African Republic is one of the first four countries on the Commission's agenda, the point was to sort of give tons of support, visibility by kind of getting a big brother in the UN system and the aid and development system, a Western power that maybe could advocate for little countries that were kind of loners in the world. To help them really sort of make that leap from, you know, the cycle of conflict that places can get stuck in into long-term and sustainable peace and development. And obviously that didn't work in the Central African Republic. I mean, it's not peace building's fault that has happened. But, you know, here we are in a situation that's really very dire, and something that when I was there almost now 4 years ago, you know, the folks who were working on disarmament and the political dialogue would have been very sad to sort of have any hint about, you know. So it's something that I follow closely just because I've been there, and there weren't a whole lot of other people who were there when I was there. It was sort of a strange place to end up. And so I've been looking at it regionally. How important is it? I can't honestly say. I only just got back to Africa full time about a month ago. And much of what has happened in the Central African Republic in terms of international engagement, especially, has happened in the last 6 months. And so I've missed a lot of that. It's certainly a conversation that happens at least in elite circles in Rwanda, in part because Rwanda has peacekeeping troops in the Central African Republic right now. And Rwanda, I mean, we talk a lot, especially at this time of year, especially with this particular 20th anniversary, about what have we learned about preventing genocide, about responding to genocide or other mass atrocities. And there are a lot of really interesting things to be cataloged there, I think. But one thing that I find really interesting is that Rwanda as a country, not only has it come so far internally, but it has really, out of a sense of obligation, out of a sense of history, taken an active role in peacekeeping in the region. They have troops in Darfur and troops now in the Central African Republic. Mm-hmm. So Rwanda,
which actually, just on that point, yeah, which makes sort of criticism of Rwanda at the Security Council all the more sort of problematic from a diplomatic point of view, because, you know, the concern is that if you criticize Rwanda too much for their involvement in the DRC, then they might respond by pulling out their peacekeeping troops from Darfur and elsewhere. Because as you say, they are a very important source of peacekeeping troops.
They are.
So that's like a layer of complication.
And I think it's not just an important source of peacekeeping troops to these two particular missions, which are obviously of huge significance in the region, but also, you know, in the world. It's also Rwanda's contribution of these troops and of the expertise and of the logistics experience and all these skills is a major contribution to the African Union and to laying a foundation for the African Union really to take the lead on these matters at the right time when the capacity has been built. And there's lots of complications there. We could do a whole separate hour on that. But certainly Rwanda's role is helping to build that capacity. And, you know, everyone kind of agrees that the ideal scenario would be that the African Union could take a lead in these matters and we wouldn't have to take it to the Security Council. So I think that Rwanda's participation in this is significant also regionally and beyond just the sort of story of Rwanda and its own narratives. I wonder whether I haven't seen a whole lot about the CAR in the Kenyan media. Again, I've been, you know, I've been in and out because I've been in Rwanda for the anniversary. I was there for 2.5 weeks and I haven't been in Kenya that long, but you know, Kenya's got a very vibrant, active, political space with lots of controversy to be had. And it's Kenya, the anniversary, you know, the first year of Kenyatta has been in office and there's always this ICC stuff going on, the International Criminal Court. Issues with the you know, now two elections ago. So there's just a lot of hubbub going on. You know, they're rounding up and deporting Somalis at the moment. So the Kenyan sort of political consciousness seems to me really to be engaged with a lot of critical issues that are going on inside Kenya right now. And you also have to remember that we have an Anglophone-Francophone divide. And I think that might also influence sort of information flow in the region. Certainly the best at information coming out of the Central African Republic, with due deference to the wonderful English-speaking journalists who are working there, but the most consistently available information is coming out of French media.
Mm-hmm. So just sort of staying with I think you raised a lot of really sort of important, interesting points. One of them is sort of the relative differences between sort of the African Union and UN peacekeeping. So right now, there are 6,000 African Union peacekeeping troops in the Central African Republic, backed by about 2,000 French troops, and sort of just as of today, I think about 1,000 European Union troops are starting to arrive in the country. But you know, as I mentioned earlier, the UN Security Council today authorized a peacekeeping mission that they want to be fully operational by September 15th, and this would be a sort of basically double the size of the number of international peacekeepers that are currently in the Central African Republic, because it would appear that this force, in both its size and its structure, is unable to halt ongoing ethnic cleansing that's occurring there, which right now includes mostly Muslims fleeing and mostly Christians attacking Muslims. These sort of vigilante groups that are known as by the name of anti-Balaka are sort of harassing Muslims out of the country in what appears to be a very successful case of ethnic cleansing. So I think, you know, the key question is whether or not these UN peacekeepers can be deployed fully and fast enough to stop the ongoing ethnic cleansing and eventually reverse it to create the conditions upon which sort of the people who have fled can return home. And that, I think, is one of sort of the key outstanding questions. But today, the vote at the Security Council, I think, is a really key inflection point on whether or not the international community will be willing to empower and do enough to help these peacekeepers, you know, fulfill their mandate and mission.
It's interesting that you said two things that I find really interesting. One is how quickly can they be deployed to make a difference in stopping atrocities and then eventually in sort of reversing the flow so that people can come home. And two, will they have the support to fulfill their mandate? And I think that actually, in a way, is you know, in one sentence, you kind of have the history of the change of peacekeeping since the Rwandan genocide. We've seen, you know, I'm telling an old story to a lot of people here, but one of the big problems in Rwanda in terms of the authorization to actually take any action that could have stopped the killings was about the kind of mandate that the troops had. They didn't have a mandate to get militarily involved, essentially, to simplify it a bit. And we've seen since then that peacekeeping mission after peacekeeping mission has been given what's called a civilian protection mandate, an obligation to step in and protect ordinary civilians should they be seen at risk. And how you implement that is a whole other set of, you know, difficult decisions and a whole different conversation. But that change is really quite significant, that normative shift, which also becomes an operational shift. And that also means that the question isn't just how quickly can we get the troops there, which was a preoccupation, one may even say a distraction in during the Rwandan genocide. You know, at the Security Council, a lot of discussion, well, even if we said yes, we couldn't get them there fast enough to make a difference. That now we're talking not only about how quickly do you get boots on the ground, but once they're there, what are they supposed to do? What do we need them to do? What kind of obligations does their presence imply to the people who are around them will be fulfilled? And I think all those conversations are huge leaps forward for the international community in terms of atrocity prevention and response. The other problem, though, with peacekeeping, we see it all over the world, especially we see it in Congo, which is now, I think, the longest longest-running peacekeeping mission in Africa, and one of the longest in the world, is that we don't always resource these things the way we need to, right? There's almost never enough troops to cover the territory that needs to be covered. Anyone who does funding appeals will tell you there's never enough money to implement the kinds of programs that you think will turn into long-term development, or at least promise enough long-term development that you can get people to come home and start making investments in their communities again. So the story of the UN from the UN is kind of often that they're always running short. So it'll be interesting to see how this gets implemented, what resources it is given, and whether they're enough. That was a problem when I was there in 2010. There just weren't enough people to cover a country, especially one, you know, half of which didn't have any roads. So how
Well,
those challenges get dealt with is really important.
and this problem is compounded when the country is as geopolitically irrelevant as the Central African Republic is to you know, to major donors, to key countries. With the exception of France, you know, CAR is, if not for its name, people probably couldn't find it on a map. And you know, but it's sort of, if you know, you see, and you see this reflected currently in funding levels for the Central African Republic. There's a $550 million appeal for humanitarian funding for the food, the tents, the medicines to help the 2.5 million people who are currently in need. And that is funded only at like 23%. You know, but if there's a country that is politically relevant, you see, you know, the sort of U.S. Congress, for example, getting sort of behind it very quickly. I mean, look at sort of Ukraine is a good example. I mean, sort of within days of Russia's action in Crimea, the U.S. Congress approved like a $1 billion in loan guarantees to Ukraine. I mean, I bet most, you know, most U.S. congressmen are not seized of the ethnic cleansing in the Central African Republic. And you know, this question of you know, resources, I think, is key. You make a good point that sort of now the big reform is that, you know, UN peacekeepers have the mandate to protect civilians, but there still isn't, I think, the sort of resources or political backing to give them the tools they need to fulfill that mandate. And that's you know, a key problem.
Yeah, I think, one thing I would just add to your comparison with Ukraine and Crimea, which is really interesting, and that you can imagine that among sort of journalists and aid workers and what here, we're talking a lot about that, the relative response. But I think it's not, I think that the international response to the situation in Ukraine is much less about the geopolitical relevance of Ukraine than it is about geopolitical fears of Russia. And so, in a sense, the Central African Republic's other great misfortune, besides having, a history of utter disinterest from the world, is that they haven't been aggressed by an aggressor that anyone else cares about. And that seems to be sort of the sad realpolitik situation.
And actually, that brings up another interesting comparison for UN nerds out there, which I know you and I sort of qualify, and hopefully at least a few of you listening are out there are included in this. But the 2006 Israeli incursion into southern Lebanon against sort of his against Hezbollah, that precipitated a big international crisis. Eventually, the sort of formulation that the International Community Security Council decided on was, Israel would withdraw and UN peacekeepers would sort of, take their place. And that required sort of the immediate deployment of UN peacekeepers. And so Europe offered up, a few thousand troops to the cause to, patrol southern Lebanon. This is not a situation in the Central African Republic right now. I mean, this is not a situation where people are sort of see the sort of geostrategic interest in immediately deploying troops. I mean, this is just a purely humanitarian operation at this point. And unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be sort of a powerful enough motivating factor to get people sort of involved in a deep and profound enough way to prevent ongoing ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, I think, well, I would agree with your summary, although I think there's also another way to see it, which is that the fact that this finally, well, not finally, the fact that this came to a UN vote, and actually in the scheme of things, fairly quickly, certainly not quickly enough to have made a difference to, the 2 million refugees and to people who've died, and mass atrocity responses are always too slow. What you want is to not have a mass atrocity, right? But I think that there's also, we could take the silver lining narrative too and say, well, it's interesting to see how the Central African Republic as an issue, as a cause even, has taken advantage of or been able to be sort of pushed through, at least in America, the sort of American political spectrum, by all of these sort of post-Rwanda genocide lessons, right? The Atrocity Prevention Board has been, I'm given to understand by Rebecca Hamilton's article in Foreign Affairs, a fairly useful tool for pushing this forward as an agenda. We have a civil society in the United States that's much more engaged of these issues now than it was in 1994. And that's true globally. I mean, so many different kinds of changes. So maybe there's a slightly more positive way to sort of look at the narrative.
I actually fully agree, and this is something I've been thinking about recently too. I wonder sort of to the extent that sort of the Central African Republic is an issue in the United States and was actually dealt with relatively quickly by the Security Council. I mean, how much is that a reflection of Samantha Power's involvement? As this is a cause that she's sort of championed. As I said earlier, she's a early on she set foot in the Central African Republic, being the highest ranking U.S. official to ever do so. And I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, if not for Samantha Power being the U.S. ambassador to the UN, would this, would sort of the issue of the Central African Republic have taken on as, as great a relevance as it has, even though that's not sort of as high a relevance as I think you or I think it ought to. But still, within U.S. government circles, it's something that we're talking about. A good example of this is that in the White House's budget request, which they made, I think sometime last month, they included a line item for a potential UN peacekeeping operation in the Central African Republic. Little sort of bureaucratic sort of indicators like that seem to me to show that Samantha Power is, I think, working the system internally to make this, to make the Central African Republic, relevant to sort of American politics in some way.
It's an interesting question. I think, and I had a lot of conversations with people who work in lots of different, you know, the whole like government, non-government sort of animal, right? The sausage making machine, in Washington, before I moved to Nairobi, and almost all of them off the record. And that's something I heard fairly often, that, you know, obviously what's happening there is a tragedy, but what's made it into a policy priority that gets discussed is the fact that Samantha Power is the ambassador to the United Nations.
That's yeah, I mean that's really, and then you refer to Rebecca Hamilton. I mean that's that she's made that argument before as well, in that foreign affairs piece that you know it's sort of her personal intervention that is that, for example, it got, you know, the US government to help airlift Burundian troops to the Central African Republic as part of that AU peacekeeping force that's currently there. So you know, it's a key question, but it's also somewhat depressing in the sense that if not for her, you know, would this just be a total backwater? You know, and or to dive deeper, is the Atrocities Prevention Board an institution that sort of can survive any individual that can help sort of make sure that, you know, crises and geopolitical backwaters still, you know, become, you know, priorities for, you know, the people who matter.
Yeah, I think that's a big question. And actually, in the conversations that I was having, there was a much more mixed opinion about that, about the Atrocities Prevention Board as an entity that really will have its own momentum as an institution, you know, in sort of the long term. I don't think anybody thought that, you know, it was a conclusion could be come to. But, you know, there was optimism and there was pessimism, and it was much more mixed than I mean, everyone seemed to fairly universally agree that CAR was brought, you know, people were talking about CAR because of Samantha Power. But there was a much more mixed opinion about, you know, if there were no Samantha Power, what whither the Atrocities Board, right? The Atrocities Prevention Board. And that brought out some mixed views. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of years.
And just so to clarify for viewers, the Atrocities Prevention Board was is a sort of interagency process created by Samantha Power while she was still at the National Security Council in the sort of first Obama administration, first Obama term, to help, you know, highlight and make sure that these sort of forgotten humanitarian crises and human rights crises sort of make it to the level of, you know, important policy priorities.
But it was also an implementation of recommendations by the Albright Commission, right? Am I right about that? I'm pretty sure I'm right about that.
Probably.
I'm not
Yeah,
remembering the
I
name,
trust your
but
I trust your instincts here.
Yay. It's good to have the benefit of the doubt. It's not usual for a journalist. I'll take it.
in our last couple of minutes, I know you have to run. Any other sort of projects, stories, things you're looking at on the horizon that we should look out for?
I'm watching now a case that's moving through the Kenyan courts about sexual violence in the after the 2007 election, and it's a really interesting case because there's a coalition of local civil society organizations that have come together to bring this forward. It's a civil suit by several sexual violence survivors of both genders, both men and women, and it is essentially. This is my own interpretive language, but it's a bit of a refutation of the International Criminal Court procedure. I mean, we all know that that's going on forever, and there's all kinds of robust dissent from its engagement with, you know, Kenyan leaders, and it's very politically controversial. And as that political controversy goes forward, as the ICC continues to make their investigations, some civil society organizations and these very brave survivors themselves have said, no, we're going to come forward. We're going to demand that the state hold its security forces accountable, not only for not intervening to stop the violence where they could, but for not investigating, not doing any follow-up investigation, criminal investigation afterward. And I think it has the potential to be a really interesting precedent in terms of the robustness, the capacity of a national judicial system to try the kinds of cases that we've seen end up more often at the ICC. So I'm keeping an eye on that. The next hearing is at the end of April. So that's the next sort of preoccupation on my agenda.
Great. Well, I know we have to wrap up, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
I recommend, I've been reading you for years, so I'm
Thanks.
so glad to have the opportunity to speak with you.
I feel the same
And I,
way. I love the digest. Read
thank
it
you.
every day.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks. And, we'll be in touch and we'll talk to you soon.
Great talking to you, Mark. Thanks a lot.